This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. When you look up at night, what do you see? Sure, cloud cover and inclement weather can get in the way, but even on the clearest nights, what you find gazing upward is far less than this hour's guests wish you could experience. Still, the pleasure of a true night sky is only part of their new campaign. They also believe their mission could greatly improve public safety and save our economy millions. That mission, curbing light pollution, will be the focus of a week's worth of public events later this month. They're calling it the Starry Nights Conference. Could it be the start of a new American trend? Paul Bogard and Chanel Varani certainly hope so. Whether you might share that hope, we'll have a chance to discover right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. How much light do you need at night? If you've got thoughts about that, we've got a phone line open for you right now at 888-WMRA-TALK. Here with us this hour, two light pollution researchers who are organizing a week-long series of events aimed at getting you fired up on this issue that they say should be of growing importance to all of us. And if at any time they convince you of the worth of their cause, you find you have a story of your own to share, a question you want addressed, or even want to challenge what you are hearing, please do call us at 888-967-2825. Chanel Varani is an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at James Madison University, as well as director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium based at that school. Paul Bogard is an assistant professor of English at JMU, as well as author of the book The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in the Age of Artificial Light. Gentlemen, great to see you both in the Insight studio at the same time.
That's good to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you for having us back.
Okay, Chanel, so let's pick on you first. Persuade me that dimming my lights at night would be a good thing.
There are many reasons, but I think the first thing we should say is that we're not advocating the elimination of light at night. We're advocating the intelligent use of light at night. The many reasons why people ought to be concerned about the light that we're using at night is manyfold. By studies done by the International Dark Sky Association, it represents $110 billion of wasted light that's sent up that's doing us no good. ET is not looking for us. That's not light that's helpful. That's enough light to power 8 million homes in the United States every year. Species that we share the planet with, nocturnal species in particular, turtles and birds, are harmfully impacted by the light at night. By the survey done by the National Audubon Society, estimates that up to 1 billion birds die in the United States every year during the migration season because of lights at night. And so why should you be concerned? It's a waste of money. It's a waste of resources. It's the impact we're having on the valley skies. Lastly, the United Nations World Health Organization has listed shift work as a possible carcinogen. There are studies that have been done in the last decade or so coming online recently now. They're correlative studies, and so you have to be a little concerned because, of course, correlation does not imply causation. But there's a link now to exposure to light at night and breast cancer. The one study that gets cited often is women who work the night shift have 1.5 to 2 times the rate of breast cancer than women who don't. And similar studies are finding that same link with men and prostate cancer. Why should you care? Because it's hurting us.
Yeah, I would absolutely echo what Chanel just said. I think that, when you talk about life on Earth, including human beings and every creature we know about, evolved with bright days and dark nights, and we need both for optimal health. So just as Chanel said, we're not saying let's not have any lights. We're just saying let's use light thoughtfully, responsibly, in ways that assist our safety at night rather than making us less safe.
What's the Starry Nights Conference?
Well, the Starry Nights Conference is all about an idea that came out of writing The End of Night. For me, I came across the country of Belgium and the country of France in Europe. Both have days, one night a year, where they dedicate in many, many villages around the country to the night, to bringing folks out and celebrating the night, drawing attention to the value of darkness and the threats from light pollution. And Chanel and I started to work together when I came to JMU about a year and a half ago, and we pretty quickly started daydreaming about why don't we do something like that here? And we thought, well, instead of just one night, let's have a whole week of events. And the neat thing that we've discovered and checked out is that this is a really one-of-a-kind thing. There's nothing like it all over the world. So one of our messages is that Harrisonburg, the Valley, the greater WMRA listening area really has an opportunity when it comes to this issue. We can be leaders not only on the East Coast, but in the entire country, and we'll start here with this week.
Yeah, Paul and I have been working on this project since July, August, pretty hands-on. We've been meeting every week. We have 8 JMU students that are working with us and putting this together. And each week it's, you know, what's the program going to look like? What's the best content for that week to affect change, that to educate and raise awareness? How are we going to do that? So I'm actually looking forward to seeing that week, because we'll get on to doing other things. But, you know, if I was to do it again, you know, Paul being the eloquent writer that he is, you know, he talks about what the loss of night is. And I'm not going to do it because as a scientist, I'll butcher it. I'll let Paul do it. But I think it's the great way of saying it. So I'll let you say it.
Oh, are you talking about just
for millions of years?
Yeah, exactly. One of the things I like to say, and I think it's really true, is that we have taken what was for millions of years, really since the start of human history, one of the most common human experiences, which is walking out at night and coming face to face with the universe. And we've made it one of the most rare human experiences. And this is an experience, and Chanel can talk more about this too, that inspired science, it inspired religion, it inspired philosophy, it inspired just our sense of who we are as a species. And now we live in a time when 8 of 10 kids born in the U.S. will never live where they can even see the Milky Way and never really have that amazing opportunity.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing that always strikes me, it's an anecdotal story. You know, James Madison recruits heavily from the Northern Virginia area. And the story that I hear, the sentence I hear refrain over and over again, is how many more stars they can see in the valley sky, the greater Shenandoah Valley, as opposed to—
These are students who come from Northern Virginia.
Correct, yeah. And to me, that's shocking because our skies are bright. They're very bright. You know, by quantitative measurements of how bright the sky is, you know, yes, it's not as bright as, say, D.C. or Times Square in New York, but it's not any better. You know, we do have areas that we can go west and get closer to a darker sky. But our skies aren't that dark. And that's the biggest thing that I've recognized in working at the planetarium. Often, you know, when we talk about light pollution, people come up to us afterwards and say, well, you know, I can see the Milky Way in my backyard. And you know, to some extent, that's true. You can see, you know, that faint glow, what we call our galaxy. But it's nowhere near what our ancestors saw. It's nowhere near what predecessors that lived here in the valley saw 50 years ago. That sky may be forever gone unless we do something about it. So that's the impetus behind Starry Nights.
I understand the official name of the conference is Starry Nights Harrisonburg. But you have people coming to this from throughout Western and Central Virginia. So why Starry Nights Harrisonburg?
Yeah, we sure do.
Why are you calling it that?
Yeah, exactly. Our vision was that we would call it Starry Nights Harrisonburg this year and in future years, and we fully expect to be doing this annually, that it could spread so that you could have a Starry Nights Winchester and a Starry Nights Charlottesville and a Starry Nights Stanton, that kind of thing. Starry Nights Shenandoah Valley. And it's really just this idea that if we start here, focus where we are in Harrisonburg and the surrounding areas, we can really start to spread this idea around.
Right. And if you look at images taken from space-based satellites, you look at where is the light footprint the brightest, you know, where's the low-hanging fruit for us to tackle, it's Harrisonburg. You know, Waynesboro, Charlottesville, you could certainly see those areas at night, but Harrisonburg is bright. And, of course, JMU is the biggest contributor to that light footprint here in Harrisonburg. So we have to start somewhere.
Wait. Let me make sure I understand this, Chanel Varani. Those satellite pictures of Central and Western Virginia, you're saying that Harrisonburg shows up with the most light?
Clearly, yeah. You could see Massanutten on those images. I don't have the image in front of me, of course, but for listeners on the radio, if you went to the Planetarium's Facebook page, like, I'm sorry I'm plugging it, but, you know, there it is. If you went to the Planetarium's Facebook page, we have an album called Light Pollution, and you can see the different areas of the valley lit up at night, and Harrisonburg is by far the brightest.
Our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight, Paul Bogard, author of the book The End of Night, plus Chanel Varani, director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium, both are co-organizers of the six-day Starry Nights Conference coming up later on this month. And let me just skip right to, well, I should mention for anybody who's willing to call in and talk to us, if you've got a question or comment, 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number. That's 888-967-2825 in all numbers. But you can also post to us on our Facebook page where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And right here, first question that came in on Facebook is from somebody named Gleamer. Where will the conference be? Where can we find out more info? What good questions.
The conference, at least this year, will be focused in Harrisonburg. A quick rundown. Monday night, we'll be meeting in Court Square Theater, showing the City Dark film. I should say, too, that every event is free and open to the public and family-friendly. We hope everybody will be involved. They can find all the information on the JMU Planetarium website. Monday night, we'll have the movie. We'll have a panel discussion with representatives from Shenandoah National Park, among other places. Tuesday night, I'll be giving a talk at campus. Wednesday night, we're having a town hall meeting in Harrisonburg with the executive director of the International Dark Sky Association, Bob Parks, who can answer any question that you might have about why we should take care of light pollution and how we can. Thursday night, we're on campus at JMU doing something similar. We're having real special guests there, including the police chief, the chief of police from Wake Forest University, who's going to come up and talk with us about safety and security and the fact that more light doesn't mean more safety, that it's really more about using light intelligently. And then on Saturday night, we're going to connect with a worldwide celebration of Earth Hour at 8:30 p.m. We're having events in Shenandoah National Park and at the Arboretum over by JMU.
Yeah, so we're, you know, crisscrossing Harrisonburg, JMU, Chris, and back. The only thing I'll add is that we're going to have Paul's book at a heavily discounted rate. We were able to negotiate a fantastic rate from Paul's publisher. We're going to be selling it at $10 for adults, $5 for students. And Paul will be around the entire week to autograph and sign it. He won't be charging anything for his autographs.
And we'll also have, we'll see about that. But we'll also have telescope viewing, a number of star parties, what we call, where amateur astronomers bring their scopes out and everybody can look through and see what we can see. And then also shows at the planetarium, which is, we have a state-of-the-art, really wonderful planetarium on the JMU campus. It's really a wonderful resource for the entire community. And that's what makes one of the things that makes this such a neat collaboration between English and astronomy is that we have this fantastic resource over in the planetarium.
How is it that so few people know about that, Chanel? I mean, last time you were here on the show, we had people calling and going, I've lived in this part of Virginia, whether it's Charlottesville or Winchester or Stanton, all my life, and I never knew there was a planetarium in my backyard.
Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea why that is the case. All I can say is that in the 3 years that I've been at JMU, you know, our footprint online, you know, we're up to now about 2,000 people that have liked us on Facebook, you know, more than 1,000 on Twitter. The number of people that have come to the planetarium over this past year is 25,000. That's a factor of three than before. So we're starting to change it.
Chanel Varani, director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium. Paul Bogard, author of the book The End of Night, the co-organizers of the upcoming week-long Starry Nights Conference, our guest. We have some lines open at 888-967-2825 if you want to talk to them. And Jim is our first call-up when we get back from the break, and that's going to be just a little bit more than 1 minute. Chanel Varani is a faculty member in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at James Madison University. He is also director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium based at JMU. Paul Bogard is a faculty member in the Department of English at James Madison. He is also author of the book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Jim, I understand you're calling us from Shenandoah National Park. Thanks for doing that. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the call, or thanks for the opportunity to call in. My name is Jim Shaberl. I'm the Division Chief for Natural and Cultural Resources here at the park, and this is an initiative that we fully embrace. We're pretty excited to be working with JMU and all the partners involved. It's actually part of the Park Service's initiative. The director's call to action is something called Starry, Starry Night. And is trying to work with communities and folks within the neighborhood of national parks to try to reduce the night sky pollution.
Yeah, Jim, thank you for calling. It's great to hear your voice. And I think, you know, a lot of folks don't know that the National Park Service now has something called a night sky team that's going around and measuring the level of darkness in as many Park Service properties as they can. And my understanding is that, you know, it's because the Park Service now considers darkness one of the resources that they are trying to protect. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's kind of coined as a type of pollution where we lose that night sky, that darkness, both from an ecological standpoint and the effects it might have on ecosystems, plants and animals. And then also from a user's standpoint, we have people that are camping in the backcountry, camping in the front country, but especially those folks in the backcountry, they want a certain experience. And with congressionally designated wilderness in a lot of these parks to include Shenandoah, it's a feature that we need to consider about people's experience and what they have as far as an overnight experience at Shenandoah.
Jim, Chanel was telling us a little bit ago that they have people coming from Northern Virginia, either as faculty or students at James Madison University, and saying when they get to Harrisonburg, wow, I can see so many more stars. I can see the Milky Way. And his response to that is, well, you may see it a little bit better than you did up there, but it's really not anything like what you could see if it was really dark. There are places in your park where it's pretty dark, and you've got people coming from urban areas all over the world. What do they say to you when they see the night sky there?
Well, it's certainly a variety of responses from people who feel comfort, you know, in light environments. They're scared. They're afraid of the night. But with education programs and for, you know, interactions with park rangers that we have at campfire programs, those kind of things, we can talk about the values, about the ability to see constellations, the ability to see star systems that people wouldn't see otherwise. I think they start to embrace it. And then there's certainly the wilderness advocates, the people who come here just for that experience, whether to camp or various astronomy clubs that come into the park and use the park for stargazing. It's a whole range of visitors that we have in the park, and some are very strong advocates for dark skies.
Now, to counter, you know, Jim's point, and I think this is one of the stories Paul, you know, tells in his book that instigated him writing the book, we don't know what a dark sky truly looks like. You know, especially, you know, my generation, Paul's generation, younger, we've grown up under these bright artificial lights. So the issue of light pollution, meaning how many more stars you can see, we really don't have an appreciation for. And one of the stories that I really like that Paul says is that what instigated him, he actually called the National Park Service and said, you know, where could I go in the continental United States to see a dark, authentic nighttime sky? And correct me if I'm wrong, the Park Service said Australia.
That's about right, yeah.
And that's true. I mean, there are places in the continental U.S. that, especially in the desert southwest, where it's pretty dark. And places like Great Basin and those parks in that part of the world are indeed pretty dark. But relatively speaking, they're not getting all that they could, you know, compared to a true night sky, a true unpolluted night sky.
Jim, it was so great to hear the sound of your voice again. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you, Tom.
888-967-2825 is the call-in number on Virginia Insight. It's easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. Let's go next to Charlottesville. Betty, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for author Paul Bogard and or astrophysicist Chanel Varani, please.
Well, first I want to congratulate you both on doing this. I know it's a lot of time on your part, and it's so needed, and I'm really thrilled that you've taken this on. I think that many people, myself included, had never heard the number of birds that are destroyed. Did you say 1 billion?
That's the estimate from the Audubon Society.
Yeah, and, you know, just that's just the beginning of the devastation. So
right.
You answered my question. I wanted to know where in the world I could go to see a truly dark sky, and you said Australia.
The alternative is the planetarium.
Okay.
And that's because that's what we try and do. You know, we have two ooh-ah moments at our planetarium. You know, one, of course, is we're a hybrid facility, so we have one of those older optical mechanical devices that projects the nighttime sky. So when that raises, that catches everyone off guard. But then the second is when we account for light pollution. And, you know, the nighttime sky that we first start showing off is one that you recognize. You see Orion. You see the Pleiades. You see Canis Major and Sirius, the bright star, the brightest star in a nighttime sky. And then we turn off light pollution. And that contrast is enormous. That's the first time that people could start making a connection to how bright our skies have become. One of the labs that we actually teach at the planetarium for JMU students is to actually count, to measure the amount of stars that are lost under bright and dark conditions. And it's roughly a factor of 4. So we see 4 times as many stars on a dark, dark sky without any moonlight to contaminate. But when I raise the lever to control light pollution, I have to make the sky so bright that the star ball actually casts a shadow on the dome. And
wow.
that's the moment where people start recognizing, my gosh, look how bright the sky is. Because you don't know any different, right? If you don't see, if you've never seen a dark sky, how do you know what you're missing?
Well, one other question I have is, what can we as just ordinary homeowners do just of our own initiative to help with this?
Well, the number one thing you can do is learn about it, learn everything you can about it, become aware of the issue, talk with your neighbors, help them become supportive of the issue. I know that Charlottesville has a pretty pretty strong lighting ordinance. We need those enforced. We just need that kind of smart lighting to become just the way we do things, so that it's not strange or odd. It's just the way things are done. I can also give you one real practical idea for individual homeowners, which is to, when you buy a new light for your house, make sure you buy a dark sky friendly fixture, one that is not sending light out into the neighborhood, into your neighbors' houses. I was just at a local store the other day that had 4 dark sky friendly fixtures that were available for homeowners. They also had about 89 not dark sky friendly fixtures. Mm-hmm. So we're working against the tide a little bit here, but times are changing. And I think that what we're seeing is that pretty soon it's going to be, people are going to look around and recognize the light pollution, recognize the bad lighting, and they're going to say, you know, we can do something different. We don't have to have this anymore.
Betty, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
So here on the Virginia Insight Facebook page, we have this from Jessica, who asks, what are LED lights? I have heard that some cities are talking about using LEDs for streetlights, but I don't understand what the difference is. Would this be a help in cutting down on light pollution, or is it simply an energy savings thing? Chanel Varani?
So LEDs aren't a panacea in and of itself. LEDs, what does it mean? It's an acronym for light-emitting diodes. So rather than these are lights that are electronic in nature that produce these photons. And the problem with LEDs is actually one of the benefits. They're very efficient. They last for a long time. They can last upwards of 2 decades. But it's how bright, how much light that they produce. It's the footprint they cast on the ground. It's whether or not what kind of frequency, what kind of wavelength light that they're centered on. Is it the red wavelength or blue? And studies are now showing that blue wavelength light is the exact kind of wavelength that's harmful to us. New York City, Paul is in fact in the midst of writing an opinion piece for the New York Times. New York City is planning to invest and purchase up to 250,000 LED streetlights in New York City. And this is where, you know, he's advocating that the city kind of pause for a moment and look at the kind of lights that you're installing. Do they have controls on them? I'll let Paul speak more to it.
Sure. I mean, the point I often make with LEDs is that they are coming. They're coming to every city and eventually every town around us. They're so much more efficient than the electric lighting we have been using that towns, cities everywhere are going to adopt them just to save money. That's the promise. The peril is that they're full of this blue light that is potentially harmful to us and the environment, and they also have the potential to be so much brighter than the light we have right now. So in New York City right now, we're trying to get them to install lights with that are not only a low Kelvin temperature, so not heavy in the blue light, but we're also advocating that they install any new lights with adaptive controls. So that means that LEDs can be programmed. They can be controlled by computers. We can raise and lower the light level depending on what time of night it is, where we are in the city. And the thing that, as Chanel mentioned, you know, if you put up LEDs right now, because they're going to last a couple decades, and you don't include adaptive controls, you're essentially putting up obsolete technology. The minute you put it up, you could have done better. And so what we're trying to do in Harrisonburg, in the Valley, in the surrounding areas, is to get the rules on the books that say, this is the kind of lighting we want. We live here. We don't want a ton of light. We don't want light pollution. So when you come to sell your LEDs, this is what we want. Please sell us those.
Yeah. And so this brings us back to the flip side of Starry Nights, where, yes, we're trying to raise awareness about what light pollution is and its consequences and how it's affecting us. The flip side is we have a real unique opportunity to affect change and the kind of lights we're going to have moving forward, where we can have input in the kind of lights that the city employs, the kind of lights that James Madison employs, so that we can actually try and actually fix this problem and not make it worse.
Yeah, light at
Hold
night
Hold on just
is,
a second for sure. me. All of a sudden, we've got a whole bunch of calls to get
fantastic.
To, so let's see if we can make time for some of these people. Jessica, thank you for that question on Facebook. Our call-in line is available at 888-WMRA-TALK. I think despite all these calls, we still have one line open. So we're going next to Richmond. Laura, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for End of Night author Paul Bogard and or astrophysicist Chanel Ferrani, please.
Yes, I'm Laura Greenleaf, and hi, Paul.
Hey, Laura.
Hi, and hello, Chanel. We haven't met yet, but look forward to meeting. I just wanted listeners to know about the Virginia chapter of the International Dark Sky Association, of which I am a co-leader with Laura Graham in Powhatan County. I want them to be aware of that as a resource to individuals and communities in Virginia who need support in local efforts or simply within their own neighborhoods. Probably the primary thing we respond to is individuals coping with really serious intrusive light in their homes and trying to manage that with neighbors and within their communities. So I want listeners to know about us, and they can find our contact information on the IDA website, which is darksky.org, and you can just look under chapters, find the Virginia chapter. You will find our contact information. And also just want to applaud the work of the NPS, the National Park Service. Would love to see that really progress in Shenandoah National Park and hopefully set a standard and act as a role model for the whole state, particularly with our wonderful state parks. It is getting harder and harder to get away from light pollution, not just celestial, but in your immediate surroundings, you know, in rural areas. You can drive 4 hours to a rural getaway and find out you've got a dusted-on street light in front of your cabin. Mm-hmm. So for listeners, another important thing to do is to provide feedback and, you know, let state parks or let places you're staying know that this is important to you and you value it and you want a darker natural environment.
Laura, can you hang on for a moment?
I sure can.
Before I have Chanel and Paul respond to what you're saying, we have David from Winchester who has a perspective apparently from another part of the world to share. So I thought we'd all listen to that and then respond as well. David, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to share a trip my wife and daughter and I took to Tanzania several years ago, and it's a long story, but shorten it. We were so busy looking at our feet, we were not accustomed to be on at night, and all of a sudden we looked up, and it just took your breath away. I had never seen so many stars in the world above me like I saw that night in East Africa. It was just incredible.
You know, that's really the heart of Paul's book. As an astronomer, I've been fortunate to be able to travel, you know, to Chile in the Southern Hemisphere and in Mauna Kea in Hawaii to gather data. And, you know, those are some of the darkest skies I've seen. And when you see that dark sky, when you see that Milky Way just blaring overhead, you can see how our ancestors would look up and started asking these philosophical, theological questions. And you wonder, you know, if you didn't have that perspective, if you didn't have that viewpoint, how would our society have evolved? How would our culture have evolved? In Paul's presentation, he talks about the Van Gogh painting of Starry Nights and how that view, which was just 100 years ago, is gone. And so that perspective is really what we're trying to get back.
More power to you.
David, thanks so much for your call. We have this on our Facebook page from Lynn, who says, I had the great fortune of spending a week sleeping outdoors in the Southern California desert, where there is little to no light pollution, a few months ago. I cannot emphasize enough the power of the experience. It was life-changing, not to mention I slept like a baby, and every time I did wake, I was not only overwhelmed with the natural beauty of the sky, but was lulled back into slumber as if in a dream. Laura in Richmond, I'm curious if you hear stories from people like that all the time saying, oh, I traveled to this part of the world and suddenly I got a whole new idea what night is like.
I do, but actually what I hear more often is the a grieving sense for the night sky of the past. And that's primarily from people who are at least 40 years old who have those memories. So when I'm giving presentations, those are the stories I'm hearing. It's what people remember from their childhood and their youth. That's certainly my experience as a lifelong Virginian, as well as having lived the erosion of the night sky. So it's not so much about going somewhere else. It's about going back to the past and realizing what they've lost.
Laura, thanks so much for calling in here on Virginia Insight today. And Lynn, thank you for your post on our Facebook page. We're going next to Stanton. Richard, you're on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Chanel Varani and or Paul Bogard, please.
Well, I just wanted to relate my experience camping for a week in Death Valley, which is another place that there's at least almost dark skies.
You didn't go there with somebody named Lynn, did you?
No. No, I think I was probably a little farther east. But it sounds like the same experience. And it is just amazing. The desert is a great place to go to see the stars. It's dry. There's no water in the atmosphere to clean, you know, to block the light. And I am one of those people who grieves for the loss of my childhood ability to look at the sky and see everything.
Richard, I know I have a follow-up question for you, and I suspect our guests might as well. Can you hold on for about a minute and a half?
Sure thing.
We'll be back after a brief break to continue our conversation about the upcoming Starry Nights Conference and the whole idea of light pollution. Paul Bogard is author of the book The End of Night. Chanel Varani is director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium. Both are co-organizers of the six-day Starry Nights Conference coming up in Harrisonburg from Monday, March 24th until Saturday, March 29th. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and we still have Richard, I think, on the phone line in Stanton. Richard, you still there?
I'm here.
Telling us about this, what sounds like almost a life-altering event, spending time at night in Death Valley. I'm curious if you came back from that saying to yourself, I really want to do something about light pollution at home.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, when we are probably soon going to replace our post lamp outside, I'm definitely going to get a night sky friendly light. And sometimes I'll say something to other people and say, well, you know, if you changed your lighting this way, it would help. So being in the desert and seeing the sky, it's really a special place. And you maybe get a little inkling of the mystics who went to the desert or lived in the desert, and how that maybe affected them.
So that's a great point, Richard. There's two points that I wanted to follow up. One, of course, is that Laura, who just called, she was too modest to say it, but she's actually going to be on our panel Thursday evening on James Madison campus to talk about improving safety and security at night by having better light on campus.
Okay, so let me just make sure for anybody who's just tuned in. That would be, since the conference starts on Monday, March 24th, that's going to be Thursday, March 27th.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's on campus, 7 p.m., Wilson Hall, the auditorium. And then the second point is that, you know, she mentioned the International Dark Sky Association or darksky.org. That's the best place for anyone who wants to learn more to go to. The International Dark Sky Association have been at the forefront of this campaign against light pollution. They've done a lot of fantastic surveys that have provided us with estimates for how much electricity, energy, how much resources we waste. They have examples of lighting ordinances that folks can actually go to their website and look at and take to their city council meeting or local county council meetings and have them implement. It's a great resource.
Richard, thanks so much for your call. And let me let you who are listening know, especially if you've just joined us, that when you hear us talk about some different dates and different events and you're trying to keep track of what's coming up with this first of its kind week-long conference about dealing with light pollution, the easy way to track all the information is by going to WMRA.org and on the Virginia Insight tab for today's show, we have a link to all the information about the upcoming Starry Nights Conference. Not that we wouldn't encourage you guys to repeat some things, because sometimes there are other people like me who need to hear it more than once in order to get it into the noggin. We have this on our Facebook page from Lawrence, who says, this is a lot of California stuff here. He says, a friend who used to live in San Diego told me that many years ago they switched to soft yellow street lights so that the outdoor lighting did not cause so much trouble for nearby observatories. Do your guests know anything about this? It created a very pretty effect at night. Is this something that would work in other cities?
I think he's referring to what are called low-pressure sodium lamps, which a number of places like Flagstaff, which also has observatories, Tucson, you'll see more of these sort of butterscotch yellow lamps. The challenge with those lights are, though, that a lot of people don't find the color very pleasing at night. And so we see the folks moving away from choosing that style of lamp. But to his larger point, which is, I think, right on the button, is good lighting, and that is shielded lighting, thoughtful lighting, lighting that is pointed down to where we need it rather than up into the sky and that kind of thing, is also light that enhances the beauty of our nights. I'll give you a great example, which is the City of Light, Paris, France, which over the last 30 years has entirely relit their city, yes, to cut their energy use, to cut their emissions, but also to create this beautiful city, this beautiful nocturnal atmosphere that people come from all over the world to see. And it's really, again, Chanel and I like to tell people, talk with people about how with this issue, it's such a win-win issue. It's we're going to save money, we're going to cut emissions, we're going to improve safety, we're going to even maybe at the very last thing we say, we're going to bring the Milky Way back to places that have lost it.
Lawrence, thanks for that question. Next to Penn Laird. Sandra, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Paul Bogard and or Chanel Varani, please.
I'm not sure that you maybe haven't already addressed this issue, but I think it's one that bears repeating maybe if you have or if you haven't, we need to know it, that light at night is not necessarily something that makes you and keeps you safe. It can blind us, literally, because of our lack of dark adaption to the dangers that are lurking in the shadows that are created by those very bright lights. And we can be putting ourselves at danger very unwittingly just because we think, oh, it's light out there. There are lights on. It's safe. It's not.
So that's a fantastic point, Sandra. And that's, aside from raising awareness about what light pollution is, that's the other fallacy we want to break, that more light equals more safety. And you're absolutely right. It doesn't. You know, light pollution has many different tentacles. You know, it's the litter of lights. The other aspect of it is unshielded light produces a tremendous amount of glare, and it obstructs your ability to see shadows and to see people lurking in the dark because of the shadows it casts. And one of the great examples is there's a photographer, probably with the National Dark Sky Association, that was taken in Tucson. And we have this on the Planetarium website, if you went there and looked at it under light pollution, where all the photographer does, you see this exterior lighting, the kind of exterior lighting that almost every home has that's unshielded. And it produces so much light because that light is being bleeded out in so many different directions. You don't see a perpetrator lurking in the dark. In that next photo, all the photographer does is cover the light fixture, cover the light so it's shielded and the light is sent down where you want it. And that perpetrator lurking in the dark is now clear as day. So more light doesn't equal safety. It's the intelligent use of light that makes us safe. And that's, in fact, what Regina Lawson, one of our panelists for Thursday night's event, March 27th,
yes.
Is going to speak to. Paul was a faculty member at Wake Forest before coming to JMU, and in the course of writing his book, he spoke to her. And as a police chief of a local university, this was something that she was very well aware of, that more light doesn't equal safety. And we're hoping that we're going to have leverage her knowledge and affect change here on campus.
Sandra, in case you have not seen the picture that Chanel was just telling us about, or you have but you want other friends to see it, let me also note that Chanel was kind enough to send us a copy of it before today's broadcast started. So we've put it up on our Facebook page, and it's pretty dramatic to see those two different pictures side by side. The first one, you have no idea that there's someone lurking in the shadows. And the second one, where the glare is cut back a little bit, you see this mystery guy just waiting for you back there. So thank you for sharing that point as well.
In fact, one of the things that we'd love to see, we're having a photography contest as part of Starry Nights. And so this is something with your smartphone you can enter. So just capture examples of bad lighting in your neighborhood, in your home, in your neighborhood, and tag Starry Nights either on Twitter or on Facebook, and you'll enter in the draw, and we'll get to see these examples. And in fact, that's where something like this is really important. If we can get folks from Albemarle County, you know, showing us examples of what light pollution there looks like, or in these other places that aren't Harrisonburg specific, it'd be great to capture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just say in terms of this light equals more safety problem. You know, if you just think about the issue of glare at night and driving, and I know I hear from a lot of folks who are middle-aged or older who struggle to drive at night because it's hard for them to see. And yes, our eyes do age as we get older and it makes us harder to see. But a lot of that is from all the glare, all the light that's shining into our eyes that's making it hard for us to see. So that is not helping us be safer and more secure. That is, in fact, getting in the way of being safe drivers.
Can we talk a little bit about birds? There have been environmental studies recently saying that more than a billion birds a year in America are being killed by cats. And now you guys are telling me that there are studies saying that upwards of a billion birds a year are dying in America because of light pollution. I'm concerned that there are not going to be any birds left, but I can figure out the cat thing. I don't know exactly what light pollution does to cause bird deaths.
Well, a couple different things. One is that it first of all, we don't really know. The statistics are up to a billion, and I asked somebody about that in my book, and he said, well, the honest answer is we don't really know. There's not really anybody counting all the dead birds out there. So these are their best guesses.
But how does it happen?
Could even be more. Primarily, what the big problem is that birds, we have more than 400 species of birds in North America alone that migrate at night. So they've done that for hundreds of millions of years. When we have bright lights, and especially on cloudy nights, when we have that ceiling of clouds, it's going to draw the birds off their typical courses toward those lights. And then they either fly around the lights till they're exhausted, they fly into the structures, die because of that, or it draws them into our cities and towns where they become trapped. And then you see a lot of bird deaths the next day when they're trying to find their way out of the cities, and they're flying into the glass windows.
Yeah, there's two points to that. One is in the definitive documentary about light pollution called The City Dark. That's our Monday event. Again, absolutely free, Court Square Theater, 7 p.m. You know, they document a bird. It fits in the palm of your hand, and its migration pattern takes it all the way to Peru during our winter. And then all the way back to the Midwest during our summer. And what you see documented in the film is how many birds collide into buildings. They get disoriented in the lights. And so, you know, Paul's right. You know, that study is somewhat controversial because it's hard to estimate. But there have been other studies that have done. They've taken skyscrapers and turned off half the lights on one side of the building and counted the number of birds that have collided and died. And as you would expect, the side that's lit up has far more birds that have collided and died than the side that wasn't. So it has an impact.
Chanel Varani and Paul Bogard are co-organizers of the six-day Starry Nights Conference coming up in Harrisonburg from Monday, March 24th until Saturday, March 29th. As Chanel was just mentioning, all the events there scheduled for that six-day conference are free to the general public. And I think we have time for at least one more call for Paul and Chanel. This is Linda calling from Rockingham County. Linda, your question or comment, please.
Yes, thank you. I live 2 miles outside Harrisonburg on the southeast corner in Rockingham County, which is designated as a growth area for residential, office, and retail. Since I've lived here over the past 5 years, light pollution has increased tremendously. Whole acres of trees are being obliterated, and a local developer whom I spoke with about light pollution basically brushed me off. I wondered whether the group is thinking about or able to cooperate with local developers to try to educate and support them in reducing light pollution.
Yeah, we certainly hope to. I mean, I think that nobody is excused from this sort of ignorance about light pollution. So when we're talking with developers or police or our peers, frankly, really anyone, it is a moment of education, a moment of just saying, hey, have you ever thought about this? Have you ever been aware of this? And then helping them understand that there are ways we can do this better. And I know that a lot of the folks that I've talked with for the book who are working to turn the tide on light pollution and reverse it talk about, for example, getting within building codes good lighting so that when any new construction goes up, we don't have this problem of bad lighting because good lights are just included. That's certainly something that we want to do at JMU, which is growing in kind of wonderful ways. It seems like it's always growing. And we want any new construction to have good lighting. We certainly can do the same thing with our cities, with our towns.
Right. And, you know, for example of places that actually have good lighting at night, earlier today we were at Merck and we learned of all the fantastic things that that company is doing.
This is the pharmaceutical company based in
Elkton.
Well, has a plant in Elkton.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And then even the new hospital, the new Rockingham Memorial Hospital, that's a great example where the lights and the parking lots in the evening are completely covered. And that's part of this LEED certification.
Absolutely. And I was just going to add that, you know, one of the things that folks can do to help us and to help all of us really is to begin to let their elected officials know that this is something we want. We want their attention on smart lighting, on good lighting, on protecting darkness, on working on some of these ordinance issues, because we have elected officials who will respond to what we desire. And this really is, I think both Chanel and I are really optimistic about this issue. This is something we can readily do something about.
Linda, thanks so much for your call. Paul Bogard, I've got about 20 seconds left. I want to give it to you to tell me what your ideal night looks like in the future.
My ideal night, well, it'd be wonderful to have both the opportunity for people to get out into those wild places and see amazing night sky, but also the night, the darkness everywhere we live, just to have wonderful, good night sky friendly lighting and have people celebrate this wonderful gift of time and space.
Our guests have been Paul Bogard, author of the new book, The End of Night, as well as a faculty member in the English department at James Madison University, plus the director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium based at JMU, Chanel Varani. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for making time for us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
You can find postings of Virginia Insight on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you'll find links to more information about our guests, the work they are doing, and detail about the Starry Nights Conference beginning on Monday, March 24th. Well, the conference begins on the 24th. You can find out about it by going to that page right now. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.